Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, a Huffington Post blogger and health journalist, and you were just listening to The Garden by Bobby McFerrin from his new CD, Vocabularies. Every week on Saturdays at noon on the Progressive Radio Network, we connect the dots between health, the environment, activism, between our personal health and our total health environment. As you know, regular listeners, every week we also have health actions. So we begin the show with health actions, and we also have a very exciting guest and conversation for you today. This week's health action is focusing once again on gas drilling. As regular listeners to the show know, we've been doing a lot of reporting on that, and now, happily, wonderfully, the New York Times has joined in and done a three-part series. If for any reason you've missed that, definitely look it up or Facebook friend me, and I will be happy to provide you with those links. It's really a major breakthrough in opening up the conversation on the real concerns and safety risks of drilling for gas with toxic chemicals in areas that feed water supplies. And this is happening in the New York, Pennsylvania area. And, you know, it's at risk in New York and it's happening in Pennsylvania. So we need to kind of look across the river and make sure we don't make the same mistakes. In this week's action, which you can find on my website, healthjournalistblog.com, and that way we don't have to kind of spell out all the URLs and everything. It'll be up and listed and you can go and click on it. We're going to be looking at laws in New York State for all our New York listeners. Basically, the gas industry is backing a bill which basically hands over land rights to them. So this means that if you're a landowner in the state, they can take your property and drill on it or run stuff through it, run gas lines through it without your permission, without your signing a lease. It's called forced pooling, and you lose your rights to your land. So there are two organizations, Frack Alert and Catskill Citizens, who have a featured action to protect property rights on that and support a new bill that has been introduced in the New York State Legislature to protect those rights from the seizure by the gas companies. So please go to healthjournalistblog.com and you can find out more, take action, and find out also about some other actions this week. You know, this is really an interesting week because for our show, because we're talking, you know, with our featured action and with today's guest, we basically have two different kinds of issues that really are in different spectrums of concern, but they have a number of different things in common, which I think you'll see as the show proceeds. So we're going to switch gears from our health action, our environmental action about gas drilling, to speak today with our featured guest. Her name is Mary Holland, and she is the author of a new book called Vaccine Epidemic. She's actually, you know, co-author, editor, along with Louise Kuo-Habukas. I hope I'm pronouncing Louise's name correctly there. Mary will be our guest and is with us today. She's a research scholar at New York University School of Law, and she's researched, testified, written other books, and is a co-founder and board member of the Center for Personal Rights, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to preserving and defending the human right to vaccination choice. Usually when we talk about vaccinations, you know, it's kind of the health concerns that are primary. But as you'll hear in our conversation today, there are also a number of legal concerns and questions about human rights issues involved with this medical treatment, which as a legal expert, Mary will be letting us know more about. And so I'd like to welcome you now, Mary, to our conversation here on Connect the Dots. I'm so glad you can be with us today.
Thank you, Allison. I'm glad to be here.
You know, what's really interesting about this is, you know, it kind of takes a different look at the whole issue and from a perspective that I think is one that, you know, families considering vaccination think about and other people may not really have thought very deeply about, which is, you know, what are people's rights to make a healthcare choice? I'm trying to think if there are any other areas of health where a health procedure is mandated A, on anyone, B, on a large population without choice. I mean, for example, you know, if one has an illness and opts not to take a drug or undergo surgery, that's one's kind of healthcare freedom and right to make that decision. Are there other areas where we don't have a choice about the medical procedures that, you know, that are being offered and the choice is in someone else's hands?
Well, I think, Allison, it used to come up a lot more in the 19th century in terms of quarantine. And quarantine was what we imposed around infectious disease before vaccines became widespread. And there are still sometimes mandatory quarantines in rare circumstances. And sometimes, again, in rare circumstances, parents will be ordered or guardians will be ordered to provide certain medical care that the medical community deems to be absolutely essential. And that often it's the case that the child or the person, the ward's life is at risk. But it's always controversial. It's always controversial. And you're right that our perspective in this book is that one does have a human right to free and informed consent to medical interventions. That's the state of the art in international human rights norms. And vaccination is really a glaring exception in many countries, including in the United States. And we think it deserves to be looked at.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that, you know, I think maybe a lot of people are very, you know, kind of not clear on, is this. You know, usually when medical, and I know you're not a medical expert, but maybe you can answer this question for us, and if you can't, that's fine too, and, you know, you can let us know, and I'll do a follow-up on that with someone on a later show. But, you know, there's a presumption that if a, you know, a medical procedure of any kind is being offered to a large population, you know, especially a very young and vulnerable populations, you know, at the very beginning of life, in earliest stages of human development, and thus, you know, most vulnerable to any kind of health insult. You know, the presumption is, of course, that the procedure, you know, has been tested with double-blind studies and you know, and all of this, where they have ascertained, you know, what the effects are, and they traced, you know, a population that has received this and, you know, kind of figured out, you know, what the long-range impacts of it might be and, you know, what all of those numbers are, so that it really can make very accurate predictions, you know, of safety and all of that. But one question I think is lurking in many people's minds is, how is it possible, for example, to do double-blind studies on newborn infants who, you know, are the ones who typically receive some of the vaccinations that are, you know, under concern for their increasing risk or possibly directly causing autism? Are such studies done on young newborns? I mean, have they been done?
It's a very important question. And in our book, we do have scientific and medical contributors, and we do have a whole section of abstracts of studies that are relevant to vaccine safety questions. I think it's surprising, Allison, the extent to which long-term health studies that you discuss in tracking populations, looking at long-range impacts, it's striking the extent to which that has not been done for vaccines. Yes, there are controlled studies of one vaccine versus another vaccine, and yes, they're done over a certain period of time. But they're often remarkably small control groups. It's often testing a new vaccine versus an old vaccine or a new vaccine versus a placebo that contains an adjuvant, and often they're for a couple weeks. Yes, it is possible to do long-range studies of people who receive certain vaccines and not others, or people who are unvaccinated. There are at least 10, if not hundreds of thousands, millions of people in the United States who are unvaccinated on religious principles, for medical reasons. So I think there are important control groups. Those studies have not been adequately done. One of the things that our book does is to call for the urgent need for more science. We think this is a rights issue, but it is certainly also a scientific question so that people can make free and informed decisions about vaccination.
Mm-hmm. In the absence of those kinds of studies, then, How can it be said that, you know, they're proven to be safe or they know they don't cause this or that? I mean, if those kinds of studies have not been done, I mean, even when those kinds of studies have been done,
right,
on any, and this is, you know, part of what I write about a great deal in other venues as a Huffington blogger and a health writer and all of that kind of thing. You know, even when a study shows a significant result of benefit, that doesn't mean that every person taking it with any genetic background, with any health condition, will necessarily benefit. I mean, there's always an unknown, even if, you know, you've been able to do that kind of study and show, you know, that this is a significant benefit for many people. But in the absence of that, then, you know, how does that assertion kind of go that, you know, oh, this is safe. Is it at higher risk for people making such a decision if, in fact, you know, these studies have not been done in that way?
Well, even though, you know, the Centers for Disease Control and pediatricians and doctors will say vaccines are safe and effective, that's kind of the slogan. As a legal matter, and there was just a Supreme Court decision that affirmed this 2 weeks ago, as a legal matter, vaccines are considered unavoidably unsafe. In other words, there is a scientific and a legal recognition that vaccines will harm some people. And that's part of what we get at in the book, is that vaccines are for, quote-unquote, the greater good. And there is a legal and apparently a social acceptance that there will be collateral damage in this war on infectious disease. And we have, under a 1986 federal law, we have a program that is meant to compensate those individuals who are harmed or who die from federally recommended or state-compelled vaccines. But one of the questions we try to raise in the book is that okay? Is that okay to give a one-size-fits-all remedy to everybody, knowing that some percentage of the people that get this will be permanently harmed or will die as a result of that remedy?
Yeah, that's that. If it, you know, the thing is, that's a certainly, I think that's a kind of a gamble, you know, that many parents might be concerned to, you know, be making, you know, unless they have some reason, you know, or some trust or I don't know what it is exactly, you know, that all will be well. And you know, is that really realistic? You know, is that kind of a faith unwarranted? But, you know, how can a parent be asked to take such a gamble?
Well, parents are asked to take that gamble with children. They can't send their children to public school without accepting that. Now, there are some rights of exemption, and I don't mean to suggest that all children are vulnerable to vaccine injury. I don't mean that at all. But we don't know who is vulnerable. I believe that studies could be done that would show much more clearly who is vulnerable. But right now, there is no effort made, with very rare exceptions, like children who have immunosuppressant illnesses, but there's, for the general population, there is no effort made to screen out those who may be genetically vulnerable to vaccine injury. And we see that as troubling. In some countries, there is such an effort made. In many countries, developed countries, there is a right of exemption, a fundamental right to say no to vaccines if you choose to do so. Canada, for instance, Australia, the United Kingdom, countries that are very close to us, they have better health outcomes than we do. So the idea that if we let people have more choice, we will be swamped by infectious disease is just not borne out by the evidence that we have around the world. And our proposition is that, you know, educated people are the best parents, are going to be in the best position to make these decisions. Educated individuals who actually learn about the vaccine, who learn about their own bodies, who know their own risk factors. That's going to be better than a blanket policy. As you suggest, there's no other medical intervention that we treat in this kind of one-size-fits-all way.
And in terms of, you know, we were talking about the, in terms of, you were saying that the, you know, the overall health stats are actually quite poor in the United States. In fact, you know, they're really below that of other first world nations. I mean, we're really, I'm doing a book on this exact topic, and we're really, really sliding down into second and even third world level, which is a bit of a, there's this assertion that we have the best health care, but we certainly don't have the best health results,
we certainly don't.
A variety of different reasons. You know, regular listeners to the show will know that I have been a longtime journalist of the integrative medicine movement, medical community, with all of the range of different offerings and practices that come into play along those lines. And, you know, one of the stats that I've seen over and over, and it's been documented in research and, repeated everywhere, is really that, we have this infectious disease model, let's go out and kill the germ. But, that model is still relevant perhaps in countries where there aren't appropriate sanitation and, hygienic infrastructures in place. But in fact, the illnesses that we have in the United States are, there's only a very slim slice that really are derived from infections. And it's really a much huger proportion that come from the so-called chronic illnesses that result from poor immunity, sedentary lifestyles, poor nutritional habits, declines in nutrient values in foods, stress, and a whole bunch of other things are really producing the highest volume of killer ailments like heart disease and cancer and diabetes and the weight gain and all that leads to them. So it's kind of like we're in a way going out with a gun but shooting in the wrong direction or something to have this there is even some question whether the kind of immunocompromise that occurs among vaccine injured children or affected children, may in fact reflect some lowering of immune strength that could manifest later in life and other kinds of ailments potentially. So, it really is a are these infectious diseases really worth, are they such a serious problem right now that they're worth all this trouble?
Well, I think that's a very important question. And the truth is, from our perspective, that science hasn't been done. Are we making the right cost-benefit analysis of infectious disease versus chronic illness? And one of the chapters in the book, I love the title, is by Judy Converse, a nutritionist and a registered dietitian, a master's in public health. And her chapter is called Sick is the New Healthy. And particularly among children, you see really egregious levels, burdens of chronic illness. You see allergies, asthma, autism, diabetes, you see kinds of rheumatoid arthritis, you see chronic conditions that really were not learning disabilities, behavioral disabilities. You see things that were not prevalent 50 years ago, and you have to ask the question, what is going on here? This could not be a genetic epidemic. It must be environmental. One of the huge differences in environmental exposures for this generation of children is a very, very high number of vaccines. And one thing that's worth pointing out is that although vaccines are tested individually and put on the schedule, they are not tested as a part of the global federally recommended schedule of vaccines. So in other words, there has never been a test done of the global outcome, the global effects of all of the recommended vaccines. And it is now 70 doses of 16 vaccines that are recommended for all children by the time they're 18 years old. That is a lot of vaccines, and there was nothing like that 50 years ago. So we truly don't know what we're doing. We really don't know the full impact of what we're doing. And I should say also another point is that the U.S. has the lowest health metrics for infant mortality of almost any country in the developed world. Poland was lower. We're about number 46 for infant mortality. We have about 6 deaths per 1,000 children by age 1. And in most really developed countries, Japan, Western Europe, it's about 2 children that die per 1,000 by age 1. You have to ask the question, why is that? What are we doing that's different than other countries? And one of the things that we do is we have a much more aggressive vaccine schedule than most other developed countries. We have more vaccines and earlier than in most other countries. And you have to ask, we know that vaccines can cause brain damage. We know that they can cause death. That nobody disputes that. In rare cases, they cause that. You have to ask, what's going on here?
You know, it's really interesting, too, because I'm actually attending a conference at Mount Sinai the very day that this program will be broadcast on Saturday, because we're doing a pre-record today, and it's about toxicology and all of that. And I did a Huffington blog, which people can find on the Health Journalist blog website as well, about the President's Cancer Panel report of 2010. And in that report, basically, they were saying that the major unaddressed contributor to cancer rates was, in fact, toxic chemicals, which have not been well studied, whether they are, in agriculture, whether they're used in household products or by industry and thereby released into the environment, or in some cases, you know, some chemicals are coming in or some infectious agents and other things are coming in through medicine. And so one of the key findings is actually that there's a whole new science that we need to be looking at, which is the science of cumulative effects. You know, mm-hmm. Right. We have a science where we look at things one at a time and one at a time, and I know that some terrific researchers are looking into singular vaccine ingredients, but how all of those add up and connect with what else the child may have as an exposure from the mother, we don't have any answers about that yet, because the research simply hasn't been done.
That's right. And so, as I said, I think before, that one of the critical cries of the book is there is an urgent need for more vaccine safety science. It's an urgent need, in addition to, in our view, greater choice for parents. The parents must be able to make free and informed healthcare decisions about vaccination for themselves and for their children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess one of the questions that really kind of comes to mind about all of this is, I mean, there is a mechanism. What is the mechanism for parents if a child they think may have been injured? What happens next? You know, if one makes that choice and the child has the kind of reaction that one has heard parents report very frequently of, you know, where there's a fever, a rash, or various other things that you know, seem regressive occur. What is a recourse? What happens next? Mm-hmm. What can parents do? Where do they turn?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, under the 1986 law that's called the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, they set up a vaccine injury compensation program. I co-authored a chapter in the book that's very critical of this program. I think that the program has not served the purpose that Congress set for it, which was to give swift, generous compensation to families who suffered very likely vaccine injury. It has not functioned that way. But there is a federal program. It's written about in the vaccine information statements that parents are supposed to get whenever their child is vaccinated. They may not get them, but you can find them on the web. There's information out there about the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. And if your child suffers a severe injury or even a moderate injury, really, you have the right to file a claim in that program. And the lawyer's fees will actually be paid. And you need to, in essence, you need to prove that the vaccine caused the injury. It's not simple, but it's doable. And 2,500 people have been compensated a little more by this program. Over $2 billion has been paid out. It's sometimes very difficult to say what caused developmental regression, what caused a paralytic disorder, what caused a death. It's very hard to succeed in this program, but it is certainly something that one should consider, the VICP. And the other thing that parents should do if they believe that a child has suffered a vaccine injury is to report it. And there is something called the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, VAERS. And they should ask the doctor to report it, and they should report it. And there are literally hundreds of thousands of reports in the VAERS reporting system. So there are ways. We don't think that they're adequate, but there are ways to address vaccine injury and to get compensated for it.
In most kinds of healthcare adverse events, they're typically underreported. Is that the case with parents who believe their children have been vaccine injured as well? Or, you know, is that not the case?
It's definitely the case, Allison. I think there's a very interesting chapter in the book by Michael Belkin called The Vaccine Bubble and the Pharmaceutical Industry. And he makes the case that David Kessler, former commissioner of the FDA, made that about 1% of adverse events are generally reported. So that what's in the VAERS, the adverse reporting system, is a small, small fraction of what is really happening. And I think that's partly because people don't bother. They're dealing with injury, and so this isn't the top of their list. But it's also in large part because people don't know what vaccine injury looks like. Most doctors don't seem to know what vaccine injury looks like. It can be, you know, muscles failing to be coordinated after a vaccine. It can be fever. It can be gross motor issues. It can be cognitive issues. It can be sort of losing states of consciousness. There are a lot of ways that vaccine injury can look. There are a lot of ways it can look. And I think people are not well familiar with that. One of the themes in the book also, in addition to sort of science and law, we have a middle section called narratives and a short story, actually, by Ursula Le Guin. And there's five different stories about vaccine injury by from different perspectives. And one of the striking features in all these stories is how doctors told these people, oh, well, you're faking it. You know, you're just pretending that you can't walk, or you're just pretending like you can't talk straight. This can't be related to the vaccine. We've all been so inculcated over the last 50 years that vaccines are a miracle and that vaccines are safe and effective and that vaccines are, you know, one of the great achievements of modern medicine, that it's very hard to criticize vaccines. It's very hard to stand up and say, you know what, I think I was injured. Or it's hard for a doctor to do that.
Wow. So, I mean, it's hard for them to turn around and
There's a lot of self-censorship, I think, in the medical and scientific professions. Again, we have an article about the suppression of science. We so want to believe that vaccines have been such a wonderful thing. And they have been wonderful in certain ways. I don't mean to diminish that at all. But like all things, they're not all good and they're not all bad. And you have to use them in the right balance. And I think our basic contention is we don't think we've got the right balance. We think that we're way overweighted towards trying to have all medicine come through a needle, as one doctor in the book says. But, you know, health doesn't come through a needle. There's a lot of things that go into health. And we may be really just failing to examine vaccines critically because we are so in the thrall of the idea that they are exclusively beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, and so therefore, you know, there's kind of a risk in that environment. You know, it's an interesting thing about that because, I contemplate this a great deal and writing about it in my upcoming book, but it's like our need for health answers is so great that we really, you know, and early on, a lot of the tenets of conventional medicine really seem miraculous, and there are many things that it can and does do, like surgery and emergency care and other things that, you know, before people would have just been goners. And
yeah,
so,
absolutely.
You know, there is a lot of reason for gratitude. But at the same time, there's also been a kind of an investment of trust and belief. And, you know, into areas that are actually more complex and then less black and white than, you know, we might have been led to believe. And, you know, it seems to me that the spirit of science shouldn't be contaminated with a culture of fear
or dogma,
where one can't speak up, the doctor can't say anything, the patient can't say anything to him. It's like, where is the fear coming in rather than, oh, why aren't we kind of holding hands together and saying, you know, what is the best thing we could be doing here to work together to solve this? Why should the medical community be pitted against, you know, families and parents and stuff like that? It just doesn't seem to make much sense.
I agree with you. And
we have a break coming up here. So let's take that break and we'll discuss this more on the other end of the break. So we're talking, listeners, with Mary Holland. She is the co-author, co-editor of a new book called Vaccine Epidemic. And I'm Allison Rose Levy here in Connect the Dots. Stay with us and we'll be back with you right after the break.
I play the tree that crawled alive. This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is Barry Farber with the best self-improvement advice you've ever had or ever heard. Learn a foreign language. Sounds impossible? Give me a chance to prove that I'm Barry Farber. I can guide you to mastery of any language in the world quickly, easily, inexpensively, and at home. You will grow culturally, linguistically, intellectually, commercially, professionally, even romantically. Get that smile off your face. It happened to me. The Barry Farber Language Club, Wednesdays at 10 a.m.
Hey, Lee.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No. Don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off! I said not to play it!
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny!
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the Mama Grizzly won't tear off your limbs. Cheater in the Rude, Thursdays, 8 p.m., Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots on Progressive Radio News Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Our guest on today's show is Mary Holland, the author of Vaccine Epidemic, a book about the legal, scientific, and human rights questions that come up around the issue of mandated vaccination. Before we get back into our conversation with Mary, I just want to alert listeners that just in the last week, I was reporting on the Integrative Health Symposium, a gathering of health leaders and doctors in integrative medicine that happened in New York City. And I will be blogging about some of the latest health findings and new directions for health repair, restoration, and maintenance coming out of that conference. And you can find those blogs very easily by signing up for my weekly e-zine, The Health Outlook, at healthjournalistblog.com. In the e-zine, you'll also hear, be able to access easily both the blogs, the upcoming radio show announcements, as well as regular weekly actions on behalf of health and the environment and activism. You can also just go to the blog, healthjournalistblog.com, to read the blogs, as well as follow me on Huffington Post. I also want to let our listeners know how to get hold of this really comprehensive book that looks at the issues around vaccines that we've been discussing during today's program in depth from a variety of perspectives via different contributors with expertise and personal life experience in a range of areas around vaccines and the vaccine epidemic. The book is called Vaccine Epidemic, We're talking today with Mary Holland, one of the two co-authors. You can also go to the website, vaccineepidemic.com, both to order the book, to track appearances, and to kind of get the latest news and happenings about this area. So let me welcome back our guest, Mary Holland, and we'll continue our conversation. Welcome back, Mary.
Thank you. I would love to pick up where we left off.
Mm-hmm.
And you were saying that it's really tragic to see doctors pitted against parents, and I entirely agree with you. And I want to actually quote from one of the jacket blurbs we have from Dr. Bernadine Healy, the former director of the National Institutes of Health in the United States. And she says, there are no sides, only people concerned for the well-being of our children. And I completely agree with this. It is tragic that we are having arguments about whether or not this is a safe program. Let's make sure it's safe. Let's all unite and let's all agree that we should do the science and we should have this debate. And unfortunately, that's not what's going on out there. There's a lot of name calling. And a part of the reason for that, I think, Allison, is that this is not just about the science and it's not just about the health. It is also about the money. And we try to deal with that question in the book. This is a $30 billion industry. And I mentioned before, there's an excellent chapter by a man who's a professional in business and has a very strong statistical background. And he talks, Michael Belkin, he talks about the pharmaceutical business model and that the pharmaceutical industry is in trouble, that the blockbuster drugs are going off patent. There was just an article this week in the New York Times about it. They don't have something to fill the vacuum. The research and development have not produced new drugs that are really drugs that are likely to make them money. And so, unfortunately, a likely suspect are vaccines which have, for children and teenagers, that have captive markets. And so it's really then a question only for the industry to lobby legislators and to get the vaccines mandated. And then the industry doesn't have to market them, right, because they're mandated. And the schools, in essence, do the marketing for them. So it's a very dangerous situation we're in right now, that the pharmaceutical industry is in financial difficulty and may and is looking to vaccines as a rescue scenario.
Yeah, you know, that's it's really interesting, I have to say, the parallels between this concern and the gas drilling that I regularly report on that's been happening across the country and indeed now more so across the world even, which is you have, you know, the gas and oil industry, you know, searching to tap out all, you know, the kind of last frontier of available fossil fuels to keep going, you know, and eke out the last fortunes and the last energy supplies that you know, might be available on planet Earth, even though there are downside risks to water, as we've seen with the Gulf oil spill and with the risks of water contamination and the actual contamination that has occurred with the fracking process, which uses, you know, over 500 toxic and unstudied chemicals. So, you know, there is a it's kind of a puzzling thing, and, you know, where an industry which is really providing a human service, instead of adapting to the times to keep itself current, is kind of eking out desperately at the expense, and in some cases, possibly, I mean, we can definitely say that in the case of the Gulf oil spill, you know, in some cases, really creating great harm to people, to the environment, to the ecological balance of the planet, you know, just through, you know, kind of a sort of bottom line imperative of some kind that has lost its sense of connection with the human value cost, the environmental cost of some of this, and it's just driven, you know, like an out of the way bus, you know, a bus that's just been taken over and is like running everything over. It's like, you know, it's just. I mean, there are these parallels.
There are parallels, and I listened to you at the beginning. I think there is a parallel about you talked about the pooling, right? So they're trying to get legal protection for the right to continue these hazardous practices, and I think there's no question that in the vaccination framework, the there are several different laws, but the fact that states can mandate vaccines for school attendance is a big legal lever that pharmaceutical industries obviously would like to be able to pull for vaccines. And then the federal government in 1986 through Congress offered very extensive liability protection for vaccines that were federally recommended. So industry has a lot of incentives through the use of law to continue practices that are not proven to be safe.
Well, the incentives are ones that it seems like, you know, they have encouraged or even paid for. You know, if this – I remember many years ago, and I hope this, you know, isn't an inappropriate comment, but I was traveling in a third world country that was known to have various forms of corruption, you know, and I remember had to cash some traveler's checks prior to going on a trip. I was traveling with some friends, and we went in and thought this would likely be, you know, at the most a 20-minute procedure. It took 4 hours because of all of these bureaucratic structures that had been put into place, you know, to kind of give jobs to various people's relatives and, you know, and other things like that. When that happened, of course, we laughed at it and recognized it for what it is. But we don't like to think of America, you know, the peon of democracy throughout the world as you know, having this level of really one would have to call it corruption in place.
No, one doesn't like to think that, but I think if you read our book, and particularly Michael Belkin's chapter, you pretty inescapably come to the conclusion that there is serious corruption here. There really is serious corruption, that we might be placing profit above health. I mean, I'm sure this is not a new concept for you in what you're doing, but that I think you inescapably come to that conclusion when you look at some of the vaccine mandates that we have in place. We have a federal recommendation that infants get a hepatitis B vaccine on the day of birth. That is a federal recommendation that's been in place for now over 20 years. Hepatitis B is largely transmitted by sexual contact and by IV drug use. It is just not rational to be exposing day-old infants to this vaccine, which does not protect them. So there are real problems here with the program.
So, in other words, there's really no rational basis for that whatsoever.
I believe that the hepatitis B vaccine has not been proven safe or effective or rational, and I do believe that it is the worst example of a program gone awry.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things, too, that I think is interesting to consider is if we are talking about some form of corruption, systemic corruption that's operative in various different areas, one of the things that I – because, of course, as a journalist, I'm very aware of what you're talking about, that we're choosing you know, we're placing the value of some profits over the health of many people, but in both the instances that we were contrasting there. And there are other areas undoubtedly as well. So, you know, what happens is I've noticed that people get what I would call a health or environmental wake-up call. So that could be one's child is among the vaccine injured potentially. It could be that one's water supply is threatened by the gas drilling practice. Mm-hmm. It could be I know people who pesticides, you know, neighbors' yep. use of pesticides have caused chemical injury in their children. So there are, you know, a whole host of different things that happen. And quite naturally, when this happens, it mobilizes people to go out and awaken awareness and address, you know, that particular cause. And then, you know, the people who have not yet received a wake-up call in any of these areas are kind of standing by, sort of going, what are they going on about? And maybe they're anti-vaccinationists, or maybe they're environmental nuts, or maybe they're this or that, or they're, you know, they're lying about climate or whatever they're doing. It's like the day that that you're the one that gets the wake-up call, it changes. Yeah. And, you know, one of the principles of proactive healthcare, which is, you know, the foundational tenet, really, of integrative medicine is that you don't wait until, you know, it comes and gets you before you address the problem. So that means that we eat healthy, we get exercise, we figure out what some of our health risks are, and we try to address them before they mount into a huge problem. And yet here we have really what amounts to a societal health risk that is expressing itself in different areas. And so the thing that I want to say to viewers who are listening, who, like me, I don't have I don't even have children anywhere on the spectrum in my extended family, thankfully, thank God. But that doesn't mean it couldn't happen when the next generation has children. It doesn't mean it couldn't be some other issue. So, you know, as long as we are buffered from the effects and someone else got the wake-up call, we can kind of ignore this or ignore that and trust it all will be well. But true proactivity really means that all of us, whether we have, you know, we're currently struggling because we got the wake-up call or we haven't had it yet, really have to look at some of these social forces, because I know, as someone who has covered integrative health interventions for 25 years, used them myself, etc., there aren't a lot of things that are going to be that helpful in addressing these things. Now, there are children and families who are able to recover children from autism and from other things. It takes a lot of really hard work. And, you know, but there are a lot of things that you really can't actually, you know, address through an individual thing. I mean, you know, even if a few people can, the whole it takes time, it takes money, it takes years out of your life, it's stressful, it's worrying. It's better overall to kind of address things as a society, as a community, rather than leave it until you know, someone's knocking on the door and giving you the wake-up call. So there I'll get off my podium. Do you see where I'm coming from with
yes,
that, Mary?
Yes, and I think that you're right, that all of the people who've contributed to our book, which is over 25 different authors, they all have in one way or another gotten the wake-up call, whether through personal experience or a child or a family member or their patients. And some of them are doctors mm-hmm. who got it through their patients. And you're right. Once you've gotten the wake-up call, your life is transformed. You're changed. You really want to prevent this happening to other people. And other people look at you and go, what's the deal with, you know, what's your problem? And that is the stage that we're at. I mean, none of the people in this book who contributed are anti-vaccines. All mm-hmm. of the people think there are serious unanswered questions, like Dr. Bernadine Haley, the former director of the National Institutes of Health, and that there are serious questions about vaccine safety, and we would like to see them addressed. And in the interim, it goes to how important it is that individuals be able to make a choice. Think about the family that does have a child who's on the autism spectrum, and that family is absolutely convinced from their own eyes and from their own scientific data about that child that vaccines played a role. And that child is going to a public school and some health bureaucrat in the capital of their state says, you must get this mandated vaccines for chickenpox. Let's say for chickenpox, not a deadly disease at all. You know, that family cannot comply with that law. That is an unjust law to that family. And yet, because orthodox medicine does not recognize that vaccines can contribute to autism, that family is ineligible for any kind of medical exemption. That's the moral and ethical conflict that now thousands of families find themselves in the United States. This is a really serious issue. We have a chapter in the book about forced child removal. There are real issues about child protective services alleging medical neglect in those families that do not choose or do not want to vaccinate their children because they believe that the vaccines will contribute to the health problems of those children.
So then, you know, anyone who, you know, I think the point here is, and this is kind of takes it back to where we began at the beginning of this program on the vaccine epidemic with you, Mary Holland, the author, and our guest on today's Connect the Dots. It really takes it back to the central point, which is whatever, even beyond the, you know, the health science specifics, which, as you pointed out, have not been well enough studied to form a definitive opinion, given the concerns over corruption in indemnifying the manufacturers from any legal compensation for any potential harm cost, you know, harm caused. You know, it's like the point is, I think, that as a human rights issue, when it comes to human rights, when it comes to health, people tend to be more concerned about my health problem. you know, what's affecting me? And, you know, so if this isn't affecting me yet, I shouldn't be concerned. But the whole point of human rights issues and legal protections is that they are in place if we should ever need them, according to certain well-recognized principles. By the time that you might need them later and then find that they are gone is really too late to be concerned about that. And that's why those things are to be protected on behalf of the all. And so because later you it might affect you in some other area that you can't even anticipate. So, you know, I'd love to hear your thoughts about it. Once again, from, you know, the human rights perspective, putting aside for one moment, you know, the scientific lack of proof and other concerns, you know, where does this position us as a society if we, you know, if we're not kind of putting up the right parameters here?
Yeah, I think you're dead on. As a rights issue, if it can happen to you, it can happen to me. If it can happen to me, it can happen to you. That's the point. And that's why we are not anti-vaccine. We say if you choose to vaccinate, absolutely, get educated, know the benefits, know the risks, vaccinate yourself, vaccinate your child. But if you have a good faith reason based on your personal intuition or conviction or science or medicine that that vaccine is not good for you or good for your child, you have the right to refuse. And in theory, Allison, the law says, yes, you have a right to refuse. But in practice, that child can't go to daycare. That child can't go to school. That child can't go to camp. That healthcare worker may not be able to work in a hospital anymore. We call it the no choice choice. There's not real free and informed consent about vaccination in this country. And that is very troubling. You can look on the CDC website for all of the lists of ingredients in vaccines, and it is a startling list. It's, you know, bovine protein, and it's mercury, and it's aluminum, and it's formaldehyde. There's a lot of stuff in these vaccines. And if you have no choice to refuse anybody, that's an extraordinary freedom that you've given up. That's an extraordinary level of control over your body and your life that you've given up.
Yeah, that's really and it also, I mean, in a sense, it seems as if it also sets a precedent in terms of other healthcare choices that could either be mandated, you must do this, or taken away, you can't do that. So, you know, I think the listeners to this show are primarily supporters and people who use and follow the principles of integrative medicine. So that's something, you know, that we have to be concerned about. Another thing, which I know is really not in your area so much, but I just kind of want to comment on it, is when I first, you know, began covering this as a health concern, I was very surprised to discover that the population of parents who are seeking health programs to improve their child's condition are accessing really things, a lot of things that are very familiar to the integrative health community, like detoxification, for example, given the ingredients that you were mentioning, and you know, kind of building up gut integrity. And, you know, so one of the things that's really interesting, I kind of wish that the integrative health community and the autism community would talk to each other more, because actually there's really kind of advanced integrative health practice happening in the community of families of children with autism. And in fact, there are recoveries, which also tells us something about what the problem is and what the solution is.
It does. So. We have a chapter in the book called A Mother-Son Story, and it's by a mother, Sonia Hintz, who's a nurse, and her son, Alex Hintz, who's recovered from autism. And it's through biomedical interventions, including a whole variety of detoxification techniques, things to build up the gut, dietary interventions, exactly what you're saying, as well as some cognitive assistance in the early years. But this is a child who's now fully recovered, now fully participant in a normal school in sports programs. That should be telling the medical community, look at this. And again, sadly, for reasons that go back to, I think, themes of corruption, the medical community has not yet embraced looking at the children who have recovered from autism diagnoses.
Mm-hmm. So this is something I think which, you know, many people who have used integrative health services can recognize because, you know, on the one hand, there's no problem. On the other hand, we don't know how to treat it. And so there's this big gap. And then, you know, to make matters worse, now we're mandating it. And, you know, that's really kind of a sort of a ugly triad. I know that, for example, in the community of people who, you know, have recovered and are in remission and survived cancer and all, you know, many stories where, you know, they accessed advanced forms of integrative health treatment and returned to their physician thinking that they would be delighted to know
right.
that this happened. And instead what they heard was, well, that couldn't have been a problem to begin with. You know?
Right, right. Which is, again, the doctors in the narratives are often told to be saying, you're faking it. This is not real. This couldn't be related to the vaccines. It's impossible. Can't happen. Vaccines are safe and effective. So it goes back to your point about science. Science should be a place for critical inquiry. It should be a place where all theories can have a purchase and be tested. But in the real world, that's not true, particularly when it comes to vaccines up to now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So then, you know, on the one hand, you have this belief, you know, scientific proof where we prove this and we know. But on the other hand, you actually have a kind of a calcification, a rigidity that's you know, due to these, you know, business interests that has kind of come over science. I mean, the idea, for example, that a doctor would be given a script, you know, and you know, told you must say this. I mean, when the principle of both scientific inquiry and appropriate health care is to look at that patient and see what's going on, not to read a script.
That's right. And the principle of medicine, we trust doctors because they treat the individual patient and because they follow the Hippocratic oath to first do no harm. And the whole concept of vaccination mandates, which are to protect the greater good, are really antithetical to those medical principles. And there's an excellent chapter in the book by Vera Hasner-Shirov called Medical Ethics in Contemporary Medicine. And she explains that the vaccination mandates are really an inversion of medical ethics.
Wow. Can you just tell us a little bit more about that?
Just the idea that, you know, the greater good has been used to great harm in many contexts. Ms. Shirov herself grew up in Nazi Germany. So she listened as a child to the, you know, the sort of cries of the greater good. The greater good is not what medicine is meant to be about. Medicine is meant to be about the doctor serving the individual patient and first doing no harm. And that is not the premise of vaccines. As we've said, we have a law in place that gives compensation to those children who are permanently damaged or who die as a result of vaccines. We do not have a safety first agenda when it comes to vaccines. We have a population coverage agenda and then a very bad compensation program for those who are the unfortunate collateral damage. That is our policy in the war on infectious disease. It is not the precautionary principle. It is not first do no harm.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's why you call it an inversion of the medical model in which we have invested trust.
Trust.
Well, you know, I think that facing up to these issues is really important. And I also want to say that, you know, very often when people who are dealing with this, you know, kind of hear this kind of information, there's a feeling of overwhelm. You know, what can I do? And, oh, they're too big. We can't do anything about it. But actually – you know, and we're going to be ending the show very shortly, you know, it's kind of like if not us, who, and if not when now is really what I say. Because it's not going to, this kind of problem isn't going to go away because we feel it's too big now and we'll ignore it and we'll hope it never comes around to knock on our door. I think, you know, the time to address it maybe was earlier, if not now, and it's not going to improve unless we do so. So I just want to thank you for being my guest today on Connect the Dots, Mary Holland, and recommend your book, Vaccine Epidemic, which can be found at vaccineepidemic.com, to our listeners. It has a wealth of information whether or not this is a direct issue for you. And, you know, please come back next week and listen to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy on Progressive Radio Network. Our show is on every Saturday at noon Eastern Time.
Thank you, Allison.